Mona said that she had sent Laura, who was a borrowed nurse from the Red Cross, to go and look at the shelled out supply room. The supply room had been shelled and just completely destroyed, and their laundry a few weeks before. And they still hadn't gotten any more supplies in because they're holed up in this Heinrich Himmler barracks. They don't have anything. And Mona said, you know, Redmond desperately needs plasma, but we don't have any. And Mary said, I'm just not taking, no, there's just no way. We do. So we've got to have something. So she orders the young nurse to go back with her. Mona orders the nurse, go help Mary get over there because Mary's living so badly. So they go over there, and as they've got the flashlights looking, and Mary says, look at that crate over there. What does that say? It's intact. And Laura said, well, it does. I saw that, but it says colored. We can't use it because, and Mary said, what?
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Our guest today is author N.C.R. Davis, who has written a very emotionally compelling book entitled For the Boys about her mother, Lieutenant Mary Elizabeth Ballster, who served as a combat nurse with General George Patton's Third Army during one of the most critical and bloody campaigns of World War II. This visceral account is based on Lieutenant Mary Ballster's letters, journals, and personal observations. It's the story of a handful of nurses and doctors in the 39th Evacuation Hospital, working out of tents and liberated buildings under the most difficult conditions and caring for as many as 400 critically wounded soldiers a night as General George Patton's Third Army fought its way across Europe and into the heart of Germany. This isn't Hollywood sanitized Saving Private Ryan version of World War II. This is the war with all its heartbreak, tears, mud, blood, courage, and grit. It's a riveting first-person account of the war in Europe, as well as the very personal story of a 24-year-old nurse from a middle-class family in St. Paul, Minnesota, who was thrown into the crucible of war. It's my great honor to welcome author N.C.R. Davis as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
First of all, thank you so much for doing this. Absolutely love the book. It's excellent, and I recommend it to everybody. If you want to understand what it was like to be a nurse during World War II, in the heat of the battle to liberate Europe, this is the book to read.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and then how the book came about.
From the beginning, I'm probably 3 or 4 years old. I was either indoctrinated into believing I was going to be a writer just simply because I read earlier and, you know, was constantly wanting to fiddle around with letters and words, or everybody just felt like that was going to be my, you know, my passion that early. So it was kind of a no-brainer that I would major in English when I went to college. But while I was there, I fell in love with a history professor's brain who was teaching British history. And I decided I've got to take every course this guy ever teaches. So then they suggested, well, if you're that passionate about history, why don't you double major in English and history? So I did. And then I stayed for graduate school. I was considering law school, but back then everybody was going to law school if they were in the humanities.
Yeah.
So I decided that some of the English professors said, please stay in English. We need your kind of talent in English. And so I stayed.
Right.
And so then I taught composition and literature, American literature, for about 8 years on the college level. And then I got disillusioned with it. I just felt too practical in my own sense of being a person that I just felt like, okay, so if I write this paper, this academic paper on the poet William Carlos Williams, I might be lucky if 100 people across the world ever read it. And yeah. I felt like that just wasn't what I wanted to spend my time doing.
Yeah.
And also I was tired of being poor.
Yeah, sure.
So I decided to leave academia and go into the corporate world.
Okay.
And so I did that, and I worked in healthcare. I worked in nuclear power, worked all over the country in different consulting roles, trying to get people to understand Title VII law.
Mm-hmm.
Is basically what I did. And then I worked in healthcare for many years and did ghostwriting. And then voila, my mother came to me at 90 years old on her birthday. We had all flown up to Richmond, Virginia to celebrate her birthday.
Mm-hmm.
She was living with one of my sisters at the time. And she asked me to go up to her bedroom after great celebration. And she'd had a little bit too much champagne, which she loved. And said, "Nan, come up with me to my room and let me get a little nap. And I want to show you something."
Yeah.
On the dresser, on her nightstand, actually, on her nightstand was this book.
Wow.
And of course, I had seen this book throughout my childhood. But of course, I'd never opened it because, you know,
yeah,
when you're a kid, you're busy growing up yourself.
Right.
You don't care about what your mama did, right?
Right.
So I went over and looked at it, and I saw that the last entry was October 31, 1945. Of course, having been a history major, I knew war was over way before that, 5 months before.
Yeah.
And then she went over to her dresser, and in the top drawer, she pulled out this tiny little book called My Life in the Service. And if you look on the jacket cover of the book for the boys,
yeah,
you can see the tip of it at the top of the jacket cover.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had never seen that. I'd seen the big red volume, but I'd never seen that.
Yeah.
And I opened that, and I noticed the last entry was May 6th, 1945. So I said, "Mother, what in the world? I see there's a discrepancy here, 5 months." And I noticed that it had been torn out, that diary.
Mm-hmm.
The last 5 months, there was, you know, evidence that had been ripped.
Mm-hmm.
A section had been ripped. And she said, "Oh, well, you know how girls are, that we're silly." And, you know, she was basically evasive.
Right.
And so I thought, well, I got to figure that out. But then I helped her get in her recliner. And she said, "You know, I am a nurse, Nancy." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Even though I'm 90, I am a nurse."
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And she said, "I know I'm losing my short-term memory.
Mm-hmm.
And before I lose my long-term memory, I want you to read these archives and edit them for the family."
Yeah.
And I said, "Edit them? I don't really understand. What do you want me to edit?"
Right, right. They're letters.
And she said, "Well, just look, just read them."
Mm-hmm.
"And let me know what you think later on. But I want to give them to you today."
Yeah.
"And I also have a lot of photographs, and we'll go through those later. But just take those home with you to San Antonio." I was living in San Antonio at the time. So I did. And
yeah,
a couple of months later, after I had read the letters and the diary, I felt like there was a lot missing.
Yeah.
You know, because I knew enough about history to know, based on some of the things that she intimated, that she was in some deep shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there were only maybe, I don't know, 10 letters that really poignantly described. And I mean, not really poignant. I mean, just she would write those letters only to her father.
Yeah.
And she would say, "If you think Mother can handle this."
Right.
But it was still just the tip of what I knew.
Right.
She must have gone through.
Yeah.
So I called my sister and said, "Put Mother on the phone. I got to talk to her."
Yeah.
So she did. And I said, "Mom, I've gone through the letters and the diary. And I want to ask you just one question." She said, "Yeah." And I said, "Give me one word to describe." I'm talking about the war part.
Yeah.
"One word to describe that experience." And less than a couple of seconds, in less than just 2 seconds, after 65 years,
yeah,
she said, "Rage."
Wow.
And I just could not believe it. I remember where I was sitting. I was sitting in the master bedroom. I mean, I was standing in the master bedroom, and I had to sit on the bed.
Yeah.
Because this lady was very reticent.
Yeah.
Never said an expletive.
Yeah.
And for her, after 65 years, the word that she came up with was rage.
Yeah.
And then I knew, oh my God, this is
a minefield here. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, Mama, thank you. Put Susan back on the phone. So I got Susan back on the phone. I said, look, I think Mother needs to come and live with me for a while.
Yeah.
Because I need to get to the bottom of this. And so my sister didn't mind the help at that time because Mother was losing that short-term memory.
Yeah.
And she had a daughter, a teenage daughter, very active and, you know, had need to spend a lot of time with her.
Right.
Felt guilty about not being able to spend time with my mother. So it was kind of a win-win.
Right.
And also, at the time, I was married to a geriatric physician.
Mm.
So that would help because really keep tabs. He used to laugh at my mom because she would say, Ken, do I have Alzheimer's? And he'd say, no, Mary, you're way too old for Alzheimer's. Your brain is just really old. So anyway, so that's how it started.
Wow.
And then for the next 2 years, on many afternoons, not every afternoon, because neither one of us could handle it, but on many afternoons, we would sit at the kitchen counter and drink coffee, and she'd talk about the memories.
Wow. And some incredible memories. So let's get into it. Let's get into her story. She's living in St. Paul with her family, and her dad runs like a bunch of restaurants at the train station.
That's right.
Right? And she goes to visit him in December 1941, and you can take it from there.
Little did she know, they typically, if she was off from Miller Hospital on a Sunday afternoon, it was a good time for her to catch up with her dad. She was quite close to him,
mm-hmm.
because she almost died when she was a kid from TB.
Yeah.
So she came very close to her father, and so they would often share a chocolate malt on Sunday afternoons.
Mm.
So she walked in and immediately noticed something was off. Usually it wasn't that busy during that time of day, but was not busy at all. And something felt weird. And she had been real concerned about what she wore because she was always trying to please her dad, and he helped pick out all of her clothes.
Wow.
So when she described this just as if it had happened the day before, even though she was 90 or 91 when we talked about that. And she just had such vivid, I would say, a feeling about that memory.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And saw her dad, you know, press this finger on his lips, like, just sit down, Mary, wherever you are, just shut up.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't even make the grand entrance that you typically make because I am not in the mood.
Right. Right. Right.
Which she just couldn't believe. She was appalled. And then a little kid goes over loudspeaker, turns up the loudspeaker, and on the radio, I guess Roosevelt comes on and announces that Pearl Harbor's been attacked.
Yeah.
So it just was such a massive, massive growing up time for everybody.
Absolutely.
That in America that day we all grew up.
Yeah.
And she decided that day.
Yeah.
She's going to do something.
She's already studying to be a nurse. Correct?
Right. She's in her practicum part of nursing at that point,
mm-hmm.
at Miller Hospital, which was a private hospital for the wealthy in St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the University of Minnesota School of Nursing had set her up to do her practicum.
Mm-hmm.
So she was going to graduate the following May or June.
Okay.
In 1942.
Yeah. And so she decides to join the
Army Nurse Corps, ANC.
Against her father's wishes.
Yeah. She kept overhearing her parents that say, oh, thank God we have three girls.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Because they knew what was coming. They had a sense of what was coming.
And her dad had been a private first class in the First War and been in the trenches of Normandy.
Yeah.
And, of course, she'd heard him have nightmares and that kind of stuff growing up.
Yeah.
So she didn't dare tell them
beforehand.
So But she coaxes a friend of hers to go and sign up with her so that she won't be alone. And then she feels like that will alleviate her parents' concern because they had so much respect for this young woman named Lorraine, because Lorraine wasn't impetuous or, didn't have the capriciousness. She seemed much more sensible than Mary, et cetera, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that she thought, well, she's the perfect one to go with me. So she's quite beguiling, you see, even back then about her plans and what she wants to do and how she can appease whoever is in charge to get to do what she wants.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a good skill to have.
Yeah, it is. Probably helped her survive that war, too.
Absolutely. And so she and Lorraine join up and they go together.
Yeah.
And they end up in Tennessee, I believe.
Middle Tennessee and Maneuvers. It's interesting about Maneuvers. She didn't tell me this, but in my research, I found it that Maneuvers were chosen in Middle Tennessee because General Patton had a grandmother who lived in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so he grew up going there.
Mm-hmm.
Visiting in the summer. And he thought, you know, the terrain, the topography is similar to where we're probably going to go in to chase the Germans back to the Rhineland. So it'll be a great place to set up Maneuvers.
Yeah.
But many, many people don't realize that the nurses went on Maneuvers too. They knew that.
I didn't know that either. They basically put them through basic training, or a version of basic training. While training in the South, a man named Colonel Scott briefed Mary and the rest of the nurses on what to expect. In a letter dated October 17, 1943, Mary wrote to her family, and I quote, "He told us exactly how an evacuation hospital operates in combat. It is directly behind the front lines. The medical unit has nurses that close to the front. It's this unit that gets the first casualties. They move at least every 10 days, half of them on foot. They care for all the casualties, American, German, and French." So they're living in the woods, they're living in tents. And for someone like Mary, who was this middle-class girl from St. Paul, it was a big challenge, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's there that she meets this man named Zim.
She met him at Fort Leonard Wood.
Fort Leonard
Wood. In Missouri.
Okay.
They were there for 3 months before she got shipped off to Maneuvers. And what was funny about Zim was everybody assumed that Zim and his buddies would go off, be deployed first, way before the nurses.
Yeah.
So it was a big irony that all of a sudden they were the ones called for Maneuvers. And Zim was still at Fort Leonard Wood for several more months.
Uh-huh. And it's sort of a pattern in Mary's life, because when she goes into the Army, she's got a boyfriend who she's planning, they're thinking, you know, they're going to plan for their future. Then she meets Zim. And then when she's deployed to Europe, which is in July?
In February of 44, she gets on a boat and goes over from New York Harbor to Liverpool.
Right. And at that point, she and Zim they're committed. They're planning to get married and so on and so forth. And then she gets on this boat and she meets this other young, handsome, dashing gentleman who later becomes your father, right?
Yeah. And a Southerner to boot, which was hilarious because she had quite a misunderstanding of Southerners. I mean, she really felt like anybody south of the Mason-Dixon line was absolutely, you know, just you lower the IQ by several decimals.
Right.
According to Mary, you know.
Yeah.
And then she found that this young man, he didn't tell her, but somebody else whispered, "Well, now you can't think that about Robbie. He was valedictorian of his class. He's quite smart."
Yeah.
So.
And even though they're on a troop ship with like 2,000 troops, right? They have this sort of whirlwind romantic crossing of the Atlantic and fall in love over.
That's right.
Like 10 days or something like that.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't doubt at all that they fell very much in love.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, I've noticed the pattern is that so many couples either got married or planned for their future as if they were making a deal with the fates. If I have a future planned, then surely I'll survive this.
I have to. This will pull me through, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there was an added incentive to saving, to make a deal with mortality. Can I please get through this thing?
Right.
And I'm in love with this person anyway, so.
Right. And it's also something that psychologically sustained, they knew would sustain them because they could think of their future.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it absolutely made sense. I'm sure going over to Europe in those days was very, very frightening because, you know, you've heard all of this about Hitler's army and how they've taken over Europe. And now you're going to go push these guys back into their country. And you know it's going to be bloody and difficult.
Right.
This is what Mary wrote on February 12, 1944, during her voyage to Europe. And I quote, "The ocean is beautiful today. The white caps positively gleam. I'm sitting on my upper bunk watching the waves go by. The food is excellent and my new boyfriend is divine. Met him on deck. Our first day on the ship. Last night we went to the entertainment, and this morning we watched the ocean together. And in a little while, we are meeting in the lounge." And so she's with the 39th
evacuation.
And how many nurses and doctors generally? I know people came and went.
That's exactly right. I was going to say that there were 48 nurses who joined the unit by the time they. They stayed in England and they were billeted in people's homes for several months. And then when D-Day happened, they knew it was just a matter of time before they were sent across the channel. And the 39th was part of the whole enclave who went over in the second wave in July. So they were there to relieve the evacs that had been there during the first wave.
Mm-hmm.
Starting June 6th. So Mary's unit arrived in Normandy and then had to do a trek 12 miles in about, July 15th, 16th, 17th, around in there.
Mm-hmm. And now this is the first time she's confronting actual combat nursing.
That's right.
And it is brutal and shocking.
Yes.
And the living conditions are horrible.
Oh, just awful. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the wettest summer they'd had, and they'd had a drought in England.
Yeah.
And then it just was a deluge the entire summer.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just living in mud.
Yeah.
And then following that was one of the harshest winter that had been on record for about 50 years.
Wow.
And there they are on the ground again.
Living in tents. And Mary, who seems to be very kind of fastidious about her appearance.
Very.
Very. And now suddenly she can't take a shower for a week at a time and can't do her hair and so on. So they're just sort of coping as best they can. And we should mention that Lorraine is no longer, they were separated. And now she has two new friends, Mona and Alabama, a woman they call Alabama.
Yes. Lorraine and Mary got into trouble over and over again during maneuvers. And finally, the chief nurse decided one of them had to go.
Yeah.
He chose Lorraine, and, you know, for years, they wondered why. And by the time I interviewed Mary, she said, "I think it was because I could speak German."
Yeah.
And they knew I was going to need, they needed nurses who could speak to those German POWs.
Yeah.
They called them PWs, but then later, of course, you know, by Vietnam, we called them POWs.
Right.
But she always said PWs in her letters. But she said, you know, I just figured that was the reason. And because she said, because Lorraine was a very, very good surgical nurse.
Yeah.
And Mary was more internal medicine and that kind of thing. So she felt like, you know, in terms of skills, she thought Lorraine had better dexterity and everything with her. But also, though, Lorraine was already having some health issues.
Okay.
So that was another reason. Mary was in great physical shape and Lorraine wasn't. So probably a couple of factors. But the chief did the right thing to get them separated.
And then she becomes very, very close with another woman named Mona.
Mona, yes, absolutely worshipped her. Mona was 5 years older. She was also a Midwestern girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't come from any means. So Mary decided, well, you know, Mona is so good to me and helps me so much with, you know, keeping me straight, you know, grounded, we would say today.
Sure, sure.
And Mona's just the, just impeccable with everything. Good, great soldier.
Yeah.
And also just very compassionate with Mary and recognizes Mary's great nursing skills.
Yeah.
And, you know, is determined to, you know, keep Mary centered enough not to go too far off from the army rules.
Yeah.
Even though she saw that rebellious nature. And in turn, Mary wanted to give something back to Mona for keeping her centered. And so she wrote her mother and said, now, from now on, just pretend you have twins. So everything that I ask for in the letters, you know, everything that if I need lipstick, just send two. If I need, you know, a dress, send two and everything.
Wow.
So that was kind of
It becomes this beautiful friendship.
It does.
That lasts throughout the war. And they boost one another at different times because they each have so much to cope with.
Through a depression that was almost just completely, she wasn't even talking.
Yeah.
During the time they were holed up waiting for those boys to be released from Bastogne so that they could care for them.
Yeah.
And Mona was going through a terrible, terrible time. So, yeah, then Mary, for some reason, had some strength emotionally right then.
And the other thing about Mary that is another theme of the book is that although she's a great human being and a great nurse and a great comfort to wounded soldiers, she's not one to follow military rules so well.
Yeah.
So she's always getting demerits and getting dinged and, you know, for various things.
You know, and you've heard, I'm sure, the AR points.
Yeah.
So she had the lowest AR points of anyone in the 39th, I think. I mean, so she was headed to what they call the CBI after D-Day. So she never really got any kind of great, you know, relief from getting through the whole ETO, European Theater of Operations, because she was. She didn't have enough AR points. There wasn't any way she was even going to get to go home.
Yeah.
They were going to send hers on to Tokyo is what they said.
Wow.
So she, you know, if that war had gone on, Mary would have been there after all.
They land in France and conditions are horrible and they're moving along. And a lot of the people that they're treating are German.
That's right. From the very beginning.
From the very beginning. She speaks German, so she's very useful. And I'm sure this became like very confusing for these nurses, right? Because you're saving the enemy and they're human beings too, and you have compassion for them. But at the same time, I'm sure that's not what they expected at all.
Absolutely. It was just, I mean, how conflicted can you be as a healthcare worker?
Yeah.
Wow. but she saw. One of the things that she told me many, many times that really showed her compassion was that she said she has this real vivid memory of those German boys in the middle of the night if she was doing night duty. And they would wake up, you know, from nightmares and say, Schwester, Schwester, you know.
Yeah.
Which was sister because everybody was Catholic nurse, you know, nun.
Right.
In Germany. So at that time. So. That's what they called them.
Yeah.
And what she said they were terrified was that sometimes they could not separate them from the Allied soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were afraid they'd just slit their throat, you know, if they were on the cot next to them.
Right.
And the other thing is they didn't trust any of the ward boys or anybody like that either, even if they were able to separate them.
Yeah.
In some areas. So it was just, you know, she said they were just so terrified that they had survived and gotten, you know, they were wounded or sick or whatever. And then they're in this American evac and, you know, they're just convinced they're going to slit their throats during the night.
Mary wrote this to her father on July 23rd, 1944. Gee, Dad, if I come home with white hair and look like I'm 40 years old, don't be shocked, because many more nights like last night will make nervous wrecks of us. It was fairly quiet until 1 a.m.,
And then someone opened a barrage on us that shook our patients out of bed. And me, well, I just grabbed my helmet and hit the dirt. Then one of the boys from the other ward came to see if I was scared. And he was so scared himself that his teeth were chattering.
As they start marching through France, every night almost, you know, more and more prisoners, more and more wounded soldiers, American, French, British, German, are arriving. And at some points, there are over 100 a night, badly wounded people.
Yeah, I think the top was like 430 admissions in one night.
Wow.
Something like
that. Wow, just incredible.
Yeah, there were 40, as earlier you said, yeah, there were 48 nurses. I don't know how many physicians, but then again, as we talked about the physicians, sometimes they would pull them in.
Yeah, and also some of the doctors are German.
No, that's right. Yeah, they had captured over that summer, that first summer, they captured within, I don't remember, but, you know, weeks, just a few weeks of having been in Normandy.
Yeah.
They captured a surgeon. And she said he was incredibly talented and so fast in surgery, you know.
Yeah.
And captured him, and with him were two ward, what they considered to be ward boys.
Yeah.
And they put those ward boys with Mary because she could talk to them in German.
Right.
And it was the most stunning thing that one of the ward boys, so sad, which I think was another reason that they were so efficient and good working with them.
Yeah.
And, but she said that one of them said, you know, she asked him, "What? How you look so young?" And he said, "Yes, I'm 19. I'm 19.
Yeah.
And I was 17 and I was walking home from school and the Gestapo stopped me and my friends, and they said, get in. And we never even got to go home to tell our parents."
Wow.
And we went to war that day.
Yeah.
I mean, just, and he said, you know, my parents to this day don't know if I'm alive or dead.
Incredible. And so they join the team and they work alongside them, right?
Yes.
And then Mary starts to develop a relationship with one of the American doctors, Captain W, right?
Yes.
And he's this very handsome, tall doctor. I mean, Mary must have been very, very attractive, a great, you know, alluring personality.
Yes.
Because all these men seemed to flock to her.
Yeah.
And she didn't seem to mind that at all.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is it. I know it's in one of the letters, but I don't know if I don't remember if I included it in this iteration, because this is the eighth iteration of this W, yes, he was, but he was, you know, quite a bit older than her and mm-hmm. probably a little bit manipulative
yeah.
on his part. I don't know, maybe he wasn't, but, you know, I would think that with that much of an age, about 15 years difference,
uh-huh.
he felt like, oh, he had no respect for the fact that she was engaged to someone else, absolutely zero.
Yeah.
You know.
And so they started spending a lot of time together, mm-hmm. which makes sense, because the other part of it was is that these people were living, these nurses and doctors, under tremendous stress.
Yes.
Physically, psychologically, in every way. And they needed to let off steam.
These people didn't know if they were going to be dead the next second.
That's right.
The very next second.
Right.
So, good grief. There are these young, you know,
yeah.
beautiful people
sure.
wanting to have a love life. My God, what do you expect them to do? You know?
Right.
And the other thing, what I was going to tell you earlier was that one time, in one of the letters, she said that that Poncho or someone like that, one of the guys came up to her and said, "Mary, you got three officers in a tent, in a tent waiting for you, and they're playing poker with each other, but they've all got their pistols out and they're pointing them at each other because each of them thinks they're having a date with you tonight."
Wow.
And she said, "Oh, I don't know how I'm going to deal with this. You know,
yeah.
three of them in one night."
Yeah.
She was funny.
And then she also attracts sort of two Redmond and
Poncho. Yeah.
They are helpers.
So Redmond, and I just thought this was fascinating too, that when they couldn't find a patient's unit, that patient just got to, you know, tag along with the evac until they could find where he was supposed to go.
Oh, I see.
And so Redmond had been specialed to Mary during the very first few weeks that they were in Normandy. He had pneumonia, and they were so concerned about him that they that was called specialed, in which Mary was assigned to care for him only to try to save his life.
Yeah.
Because he was so, so sick.
Yeah.
And he was a private first class from a tank unit.
Uh-huh.
And they were able to save him.
Yeah.
But then by the time he got well enough to go back and join his tank unit, they couldn't find it. You know, it would make sense in war.
Sure.
Yeah. And then so for the next 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
He tagged along and told the chief that he wanted to work with Mary, and he would just help Mary so much because she was his girlfriend. And of course, Mary was mortified because she was, I think, 24, and he was 19. So she felt like she was an old woman and he was just a child, and very embarrassed. Plus, you know, enlisted could not date officers. And so that was a big taboo. And so she was real worried that, you know, the chief nurse would think that was a consensual feelings for each other. And it wasn't. She just saw him as a kid, but one that she was quite close to and wanted to make sure that he was safe and well cared for until he got through with the pneumonia. But anyway, then he shows back up in the unit wounded so terribly.
He just helps out. He follows the unit as they're moving through France.
Yeah.
And Pancho, now where did he come from?
Pancho was a guy that was at Fort Leonard Wood.
Okay.
And then was moved with them to maneuvers. And so she had known Pancho throughout the entire, her service through the whole thing.
Okay.
And he was kind of an assistant to the chief, but also he did all kinds of errands, whatever needed to be done in the unit.
Like a logistics guy.
Yes. Yeah, but he just loved Mary so much, and she gave him all of her liquor rations, and, you know, if they needed to dig a hole, a foxhole, or a hole for them to sleep in during the night, you know, she'd go to him, and he'd dig the hole for her, and she'd give him liquor rations, you know.
Yeah, wow. And as they begin moving through France, they're sleeping in foxholes often, with rain and snow and planes bombing them, buzzing overhead.
Constantly. They paid no mind to the crosses that were on top of those tents.
Yeah.
They lined them up in the form of a cross, and then they painted crosses on the top of all the tents. The Germans didn't care.
Yeah.
You know, and then sometimes they would find shelled out buildings or an enclave of buildings, but they were all of these units were fighting over those. They would send reconnaissance out to find them and get. And then they would have to send a request to Tusa.
Yeah.
And then Tusa would say, oh, sorry, you know, so-and-so unit's already going to take that place.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a constant problem for Colonel Brocker to deal with. It was just his major headache.
Yeah.
And to try to find them a decent place, you know, sometimes just to try to get them off the ground, you know.
And as General Patton moved through France and into eventually Germany, he wants the 39th right there with him.
Yes, and she overheard that conversation of him on the phone with Colonel Brocker one day, because she was in the COMZ, because communication zone was where they did dental treatment, and Mary's teeth were falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
They did not had any nutrition for so long.
Yeah.
And so she was in there waiting for dental work and had to sit in the area where they had the phone. The engineers would get the phone lines going with each place they got to.
Right.
And she overheard him talking to General Patton on the phone. And he said, I don't want my nurses that close to the fighting.
Yeah.
And General Patton said, well, my boys are there. So the girls are going to be there. Too bad.
Yeah.
And of course, Patton was very much, you know, he looked at those people as a war machine. He did not look at them as individual human beings. And, you know, I mean, that's why he was the general, because you can't.
That's right. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
This is a war of attrition.
Right. And so being so close to the front lines expose them to even more danger.
Yes.
So there was really no safety. It wasn't like they were 100 miles behind the front lines. They were right there.
They were right there because the way that the Third Army and the different armies, I found out, actually probably I found this out. I still do research.
Yeah.
After the book was released, was different armies did it different ways. And the way Third Army decided to do it was they would have the EMs, the emergency medics, right there on the field of battle.
Oh, wow.
And what they were supposed to do is tag the patient and get them to the field hospital and just patch them up as much as they could, and then quickly send them to the evac, which was just, you know, maybe a mile back or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was usually the way they treat. And then when they got to the evac, they were triaged.
Yeah.
But a lot of times Mary got real frustrated because, you know, they wouldn't be tagged.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't know what was wrong with them.
Right.
Because those EMs didn't have time. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Get them out of here. Yeah. And then while she's in Normandy also, when the sun comes out, it's beautiful, right? So there's flowers everywhere, beautiful fields. They try to grab a picnic here and there. So it's this crazy contrast, right?
It is. And I didn't realize until I began really getting into, because I never took a military history course of World War II. And I didn't realize that it was more skirmishes.
Yeah.
Than it was just these great, you know, massive amounts of, you know, but that on the other hand was quite dangerous because you never knew where snipers were going to be.
Right.
You know, there were just all these tiny enclaves of the enemy everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't like there were like fixed lines.
Exactly. Right. That's what I meant to say. Exactly.
You know, you could be thinking you were in a, you know, behind the Allied lines, and then you'd run into a pocket of Germans who were left behind or something like that.
That's right.
So it was very dangerous. And then, of course, there were landmines and there were bombing and strafing all the time.
All the time.
It's just relentless, right?
It is.
It's relentless fighting. It's relentless dealing with the weather, dealing with the conditions, moving also because they're always on the move. And running out of supplies. Patton is desperate for gasoline because he wants to move quickly.
Yeah, he's pretty much stuck for a while in September because politically they decided to give Monty the gas that they had. I see it even in when I was doing consulting with companies, when the leadership is stressed, everybody down the line is stressed.
Right.
It's a major problem like that.
And Mary is just constantly dealing with death and dying and sickness, right? And you can see in reading the letters, like the psychological toll just starts sort of mounting and they kind of get darker and darker. Here's a letter from Mary written in September 1944. Quote, casualties have been severe and heavy. Everyone is irritable and tense. Gosh, sometimes I think I can't look at one more wound or some awful sight. Tonight, tears came to my eyes when we admitted a poor boy who was shot down last May and has been a prisoner until the town in which he was held was liberated by our soldiers. Within 6 hours after our troops moved in, they brought him in. I shivered. An amputated arm, part of his nose gone, can't close his mouth, and a horribly scarred face from gasoline burns. His eyes and head are bandaged, but when I spoke to him as he was brought in, he said, "My God, an American girl. I want to cry." And he did, and he didn't know it, but I did too. And also, she's worried about
Robbie,
who is off somewhere else. He's with a tank.
Yeah, Robbie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as she knows, he's in a tank somewhere.
Yeah.
And she had seen by then the tank injuries.
Yeah. Which are horrible. They're the worst. Yeah.
Because
they're burned and it's just awful. And Mary and Mona are supporting one another because Mona goes into these periods of depression.
Yes.
And it seems like a big outlet for Mary are the letters home, especially to her father, because she, as you mentioned before, she feels she can confide a lot more to her father than she can to the mother, because some of this stuff is rough, really rough.
Yes. In the letters, though, you know, sometimes it'll be blackened out and say censored.
Okay.
And so I guess what the typist did was she just tried to mimic what was in the writing of the letters and when she was transcribing them. And if it was marked out censored, then she did the same thing in the
right.
in the typing.
Yeah, because all the letters home were being read.
Every one of them.
Yeah.
I really don't. I mean, I think it was because there's a lot of censored.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or they were just worried about Mary and they were reading all hers.
We got to keep an eye on this one. And they didn't want bad news going back to the States.
And the other thing is she often hints, well, Daddy, I'm sure you know more than we do.
Yeah.
Hoping that maybe he'll send something back to her.
Yeah.
That would give her some news.
Yeah, because they don't have news either.
No. They have stars and stripes sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some of those old stars and stripes. She kept some of them.
Oh, wow.
Of course, there's a lot of propaganda in there.
Yeah, sure. When they get to August, they have some of the bloodiest days, 125 admissions on the 2nd.
One of the injuries that bothered her the most was trench foot, though, because she saw no reason for it.
Yeah.
You know, she just felt like we had really failed our soldiers to not put them in decent boots.
And that was a big problem.
It was, you know, and they would often, when they started in, you know, if they would find Germans dead, they would definitely try to take their shoes. They had much better boots, combat boots.
Theirs were waterproof. And at a certain point, she writes in one of her letters, like she's too busy to be scared.
Yeah.
There's just so much going on. After a while, she becomes almost inured to the airplanes overhead. It's just like, hey.
She said it's 4th of July. That's the way she would describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And 4th of July around here every night. And that's the way we decide we're going to say that, it, you know, and we just pretend that it is.
At the end of September 1944, Mary wrote, "No wonder so many of our boys crack up, because the horrible suffering, distorted minds, and death I've witnessed in 9 weeks. It's almost more than one can take, but we can't let it get us down. And the one thing I pride myself on is that I've never revealed my inner thoughts or moods on duty." And then one night, they're still in France, they're moving north, and they go out, Mona and Mary go out.
Oh, yeah.
To a cafe in a town called Virtus.
Yes.
Just to get a night out. They hear there's a cafe in this town that's still operating.
So they go there. I think it was 3 or 4 couples, and W was with Mary, and a new major that Mona had just met, named Major Bryson, that comes up later, was her date, and I think 2 other couples. And they put them in a room by themselves, a nice little dining room. And Mary had a great description. It was very vivid about what it looked like. And then all of a sudden, they feel this explosion, mm-hmm. kind of like an earthquake, it almost.
Yeah.
And next thing they know, the restaurant's on fire, and they're all on the floor. And they're W and Bryson help get them all out a window, and then they watch the restaurant burn to the ground outside.
Wow.
And wow, I mean, it's just unbelievable. You know, they were just trying to have a good meal.
And she gets in trouble because she misses bed check that night.
Yes.
Yeah. And then there's a Bing Crosby visit.
Yeah. I think August 14th.
Yeah.
Yeah. My agent, Peter Riva, is the grandson of Marlena Dietrich, the actress. And then I realized Mom has a picture. I realized when I looked at Peter Riva, who's just this wonderfully successful agent. And I saw, well, he's running Marlena Dietrich's estate.
Yeah.
And because it was on his website. And I thought, well, my mother has a picture of Marlena Dietrich because she got to meet her.
Mm-hmm.
So I put that in the subject line to Peter Riva and said, "A picture of your grandmother attached."
Yeah.
So that he would look at the email.
That's smart.
And he did. And I, of course, also attached my manuscript.
Yeah.
And at that time, I think it was my 4th or 5th iteration.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear from him for months.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, I heard from him.
In late 1944, Mary wrote, quote, "The consensus at present is that politics are holding up things here.
The general feeling is a bitter one, because why should those war lovers sit back in our U.S. and just let this mess go on while boys are dying and sweating it out in their cold, muddy foxholes, existing on cold K rations and wondering why they're here? So finally, Robbie comes to visit her. Close to Christmas of 1944.
Yes, December 10th.
Yeah.
He's there for a couple of hours because by then he's doing logistics.
Yeah.
So he was there to see her, but he also was there because he was in First Army and he needed to talk logistics with some of the people there in the unit. Mm-hmm. So he killed two birds with one stone and got to meet with Colonel Brocker and a couple of people to kind of inform them of what First Army was doing logistics wise. And then he got to spend a little time with Mary.
And that was a big boost for her morale.
It was. But she did tell W, you stay away because Robbie's coming to visit today.
Yeah. And then getting into December, the fighting really intensifies.
Yes.
Because they're getting closer to the German border. And the Germans are becoming more and more desperate to stop the Third Army. And I mean, you put some numbers in here, I think from the 12th to the 13th, 12th, 13th, and 14th, there were like 100 in every night. It would be over 100 to 150 new seriously wounded soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then Redmond, he went off with his tank unit and he comes back and he's badly wounded. And I'm sure this must have been absolute nightmare for Mary, because suddenly her friend, the guy who was helping her out, he shows up as a wounded soldier, badly wounded.
Yeah. I think he had tank burns over 40% of his body. He had a bullet wound to the chest. He was in terrible shape. And Mary was getting sick at the time when she reported to duty that night. And years later, we found out because of me that what she had was hereditary angioedema, but we didn't know at the time until I presented with it and got diagnosed.
Okay.
When I was in my 40s.
Yeah.
So then I hadn't even read the letters back then.
Yeah.
And then when I read the letters and this bizarre swelling, this edema that would show up in one of her limbs and her foot and then go to the other foot, I had the same thing.
Ah.
But by the time I had it, we had immunologists and rheumatologists to be able to diagnose it. And then it all made sense. Oh, mother, you had hereditary.
So it was a hereditary that is triggered by a stress or lack of sleep or.
Usually, you're already sick or you're getting sick. Your immune system is, trying to fight.
Yeah.
Something. And she said she was having a raging flu bug and a massive headache. And then, one of her feet again is swollen.
Yeah.
And she can't walk on it.
Right.
But by God, she's going in for duty that night. And then Mona, who's running the unit that night in surgical, says, I don't even know how to tell you this.
Yeah.
Redmond's here.
Yeah. In bad shape.
And there was not any plasma for Redmond. So
what does Mary do?
So Mona said that she had sent Laura, who was a borrowed nurse from the Red Cross, to go and look at the shelled out supply room. The supply room had been shelled and just completely destroyed, and their laundry a few weeks before.
Yeah.
And they still hadn't gotten any more supplies in because they're holed up in this Heinrich Himmler barracks.
Yeah.
So there's, they don't have anything. And Mona said, Redmond desperately needs plasma, but we don't have any.
Yeah.
And Mary said, I'm just not taking, no, there's just no way.
Yeah.
We do. So we've got to have something.
Yeah.
So she orders the young nurse to go back with her. Mona orders the nurse, go help Mary get over there because Mary's limping so badly.
Yeah.
Go help Mary go over supply and see.
Yeah.
And, Laura says, there's nothing there. And she said, well, let her look. She's not going to be happy until she could look. I mean, she's very close to this patient.
Right.
So they go over there, and as they've got the flashlights looking, and Mary says, look at that crate over there. What does that say? It's intact. And Laura said, well, it does. I saw that. But it says colored. We can't use it. And Mary said, what?
Yeah, who cares?
That is the most ridiculous. She was so furious.
Yeah.
So she kind of limps over there and gets to it. And opens the crate, you know, sure enough, each bottle is labeled color. Can you imagine?
Crazy.
And it's just disgusting to think about that.
Yeah.
That the Army could be so stupid and
yeah,
and so prejudicial. And so Mary just rips the label off four of them and shoves them in Laura's arms and says, "Get back over there right now."
Yeah.
And so anyway, Mary is turned in for that, for not following Army regulations.
But in that case, the chief sympathizes with her.
Yes, she does. She does the right thing. And she says, "Mary, you saved Redmond's life that night. You saved several boys' lives that night."
Yeah.
And I just thought it was just so wonderful that, you know, she just, when I was interviewing her about that, and she said, "Of course, now you could never relate to that." I mean, I taught Title VII law. So, I mean, I fought for civil rights
right.
for years. I've been, you know, American civil liberties person, you know, and I was just, you know, really into it. And then she said, "I know you cannot relate to this, but that's the way it was back then. But I was never raised like that. And I just could not." She said, "I was kind of like thinking like you do today. How absurd."
Of course.
"Boys are just boys."
Right.
"There's no difference." Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy. And so she ends up saving Redmond. And then they moved to Belgium.
Yeah.
And they're staying in a Catholic girls' school. And by this time, they had treated 10,000 patients, which is insane.
When you think about the amount of time.
I know.
Because it was the middle of July when they got set up.
And we're talking about like 48 nurses here and some doctors. I mean, it's just
incredible. And they'd already lost some nurses by then.
I'm sure.
And some of the nurses intentionally got pregnant so they could get the hell out of there.
And they decide to take an afternoon to go see Saint Hubert.
Major Bryson and Mona and W and Mary went on this excursion.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they get into deep trouble by doing that. They get strafed. The Jeep, you know, they have to abandon the Jeep and find a place to stay.
Yeah.
And it's not been cleared out of enemy in this barn they find to stay the night because they're in a terrible snowstorm.
Yeah.
And I told the reader, oh, believe me, Bryson apparently was just beside himself. He was kicking himself for doing something so stupid.
Yeah.
You know, but I said, you got to remember this guy, when he first showed up at the unit that day to visit with Mona, he'd been in battle for months and he wasn't thinking clearly.
Sure.
You know, he was exhausted. They said he just didn't even look like the same person. He probably dropped 30 or 40 pounds. He's just emaciated.
Right.
You know, you cannot expect human beings to go through all that kind of stuff and then expect them to make impeccable decisions every day.
Right.
And he's, you know, kind of off, you know, thinking, oh, God, I just need a break. I just want to take my girlfriend.
Let's go for an excursion. The four of us will drive into the country. We'll go visit this little town. And it turns into a nightmare.
So a storm was coming as they return from Saint-Hubert to try to get back to the post where they were currently. They're seeing the clouds roll in and it's looking pretty heavy and it's getting to be dusk. But where they are is still clear.
Yeah.
And you know the old term of bomber's moon.
Yeah.
And, you know, they always were, oh, God, you know, planes are going to be flying tonight because they can see.
Right.
You know? So unfortunately, they were in a Jeep and in a place where there was still very good visibility. And as they're driving back toward the post, here comes the strafing.
Yeah.
They start getting strafed.
Yeah.
And they have to pull the Jeep to the side of the road and duck into a ditch. And then they realize, oh, my God, you know, we're really like sitting ducks here.
Sure.
And so then Mona, who was known to be very observant, anybody notice anything where we could kind of hold up? And Mona said, I did. I noticed a barn.
Mm-hmm.
And Major Bryson said, do you remember how far back it may have been? And she said, I think it was maybe a mile back or so.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, okay, you guys stay in the ditch. I'm going to go and see if I can't find it.
Yeah.
And he said, do you remember any tracks? Because I can't just walk into a field.
Yeah.
And she said, I do. I remember tracks leading up to one of the entrances.
Yeah.
So he said, okay, because he wasn't going to go if, you know, they just have to spend the night in the ditch and hope they didn't freeze to death.
Yeah.
So he goes and he does find it. It was a little bit more than a mile, but, you know, he does find it and he checks it out. Then he goes back and gets the three and they make the trek to the barn. And while they're there, they do all this logistics of, okay, we know there's Germans, you know, around still. So we've got to do something to try to hold up in here safely so they could concoct all these ideas to try to, you know, bar one exit, entrance into the barn and do all these things. And then they make a hay room so that they can get warm.
Yeah.
And then as they're going around the barn looking for hay and looking for anything they might use, Mary and Mona stumble upon a German soldier who's lying comatose.
Wow.
And they feel like, well, we've got to help this guy. I mean, you know, caregiver first.
They're nurses. Yeah.
And so then they run and get, Mary runs and gets the two men. And she says, come on, I found a patient and we got to help him. So
yeah.
They drag him to the hay room.
Yeah.
But then they figure, oh my God, his comrades are going to come try to find him.
Right. Right.
Probably tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Sure enough, they do. And so then they're, you know, they have to set up how they're going to be able to take on the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do. And it ends up that Bryson has to kill two that are coming toward him. And he had told the other three they'd made an escape hatch in that hay room to go out of the barn if the enemy shows up.
Yeah.
Sure enough, here they come. So he says, get out. But then they just forgot. They're exiting from a place that didn't have the tracks, the tank tracks.
Yeah.
Therefore, they may be on a landmine. They don't know it.
Yeah.
And so then he's realizing, and all of a sudden, he just scurries to get down the ladder after he shot these two Germans. He scurries down the ladder to try to get them to not go any further, not take one more step. And he falls and he crushes his ankle.
Yeah.
Upon trying to get down the ladder. It's just a disaster in every way, you know?
Yeah.
And so then, of course, he, by the time he gets down there and scoots through and, you know, he says, stop. And so they just have to stop where they are. And then just, they just all feel like, oh my God, we, you know, and all they know to do is just trace back the steps that they had taken.
Right.
One by one to get back to the barn.
Yeah.
And they do that. But little do they know that Mary is already chronically dehydrated.
Yeah.
And they just don't realize, they missed it. There's too much going on.
Right.
You know, that's what happens. You just see one mistake after another, because that's just reality when you're in a situation like this.
Right. You're dealing with the circumstances in front of you and you forget, like we don't have any water.
They'd run out of water and she got real sick and they just started thinking, well, you know, she's done so, you know, they just didn't think of dehydration.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't until after the guys leave to try to get back to the Jeep and go back to the post to get help that they, you know, they've got this German that's dying there and they've got Mary who's sick and, you know, somebody's got to go back and get help.
Yeah.
And so they decide to separate and do that. But it was during the time that Mona was left with Mary alone and the soldier that was wounded. Mona realizes, oh my God, Mary's chronically dehydrated.
Yeah.
And then Mary just goes into this, you know, kind of other world, just a hallucinatory series until Mona has to do something drastic. And then, you know, they get her back and Bryson undergoes surgery and all that. But it was just...
And she gives her a barbiturate, which saves her life, right?
The barbiturate saved her life, yeah.
During the first week of 1945, the 39th Evacuation Hospital processed its 10,000th patient. A few weeks earlier, Patton's Third Army had defeated the Nazis at Bastogne, Belgium. Now they were passing through Luxembourg on their way to Germany. Mary wrote,
quote, "Of course, we passed through what's left of Bastogne and every town from then on. They were all ghost towns. The wrecked tanks, planes, vehicles, dead horses and cattle along the roadside detracted from the beautiful country."
But you know, then Mary tells me later that didn't happen to her.
What?
She says, well, not later, really. Well, she does tell me later, but before, all through my childhood, she said, you know, there were two nurses and they went off with two officers and they got in a barn or something and they all got killed.
Mm-hmm.
And then after this, then I went back and asked her, now, wait a minute, was that you?
Yeah.
Or was that some other four that went off and they got killed?
Yeah.
And she had such specificity with this story. So I don't, you know,
yeah,
this is the thing about, so I thought, well, I've got to put that in there because I can't find if it really happened or not because there's no records of all that stuff.
Right. They don't keep records of things like that.
No. So, you know, but I think it did happen to her.
Yeah.
And that she just, I don't know, sometimes it seemed like she would tell me something and then she would pull back from it.
You know, you see it in the letters too. You know, I think she's always aware of how things are going to be received by other people. She seemed to be one of those people who's very sensitive to that. So she probably was worried, you know, she's like, well, we really screwed up and we ended up killing two people and also almost getting killed. And that's somewhat embarrassing.
That's true.
What are people going to think?
Yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah. She wanted to retract that.
But, you know, what's interesting when you read the letters, and everybody listening should read the book, she's really growing up fast.
Yes.
This is only a short period of time, really months. And you can hear it in her letters. And I just want to read one. This is from November 14th. She goes, "Daddy, if our boys don't get their jobs back and have all the things they've been told they're fighting for, the people in the U.S. are going to see what war is like because these boys are not boys that left home. Although because they're Americans, I guess, they can still laugh and joke and tease and hand out famous Yankee line, which really never gets tiresome. Although I hear it every day of my life. But there's something else that you don't discuss until you listen to these soldiers and learn that there is bitterness and hatred in their minds too, because they've seen their best buddy killed and because the best years of their lives are being spent in a useless way. It's going to take time to heal these mental scars." So, you know, all of this death and destruction is having a profound effect on her.
Right.
They cross the Moselle River. They're going into Germany. 60 American GIs drown crossing the river because it's so overrun.
Yes.
And in the midst of this, Mary gets an engagement ring from Robbie.
And, you know, that's, they were staying in that place that was right by where all the many, many thousands of people had been thrown into a pit. And the stench was so horrible while they were there. I mean, I can't even imagine. And then she gets this. I mean, how odd.
Yeah. strange timing.
What? Bad timing.
This little box arrives and it's her engagement ring from Robbie. And then they're in Germany. They're near Buchenwald in April 45. And Mary chooses not to visit. It's just too much. And then she finally, May 8th, 1945, is VE Day. So brief celebration,
yeah.
But Mary's work isn't over. On May 6, 1945, Mary wrote in her letter to her family, quote, "Now the roads are lined with millions of downtrodden Germans. They seem to be lost, some in uniform, the rest ragged clothes, traveling in everything from ox-drawn carts to trailers and wagons, and anything they can obtain. It all looks like a mess and will take years to straighten out."
I mean, immediately they have her watching this film On to Tokyo.
Yeah. And the destruction that they see in Germany is just absolutely devastating.
Yes. And she just cannot get over such a gorgeous country.
Yeah.
Absolutely destroyed.
Crazy.
And then when she goes to later on in the summer, when she's stationed at a station hospital in Germany, and everything is just the most high tech stuff she's ever seen in her life. I mean, they had electric doors, indoor swimming pools, you know, just opulence and just this stuff she never thought of. You know, it looked like the Germans were so advanced,
very advanced society. Yeah.
And then to see what they had brought on themselves, it just was devastating to her and her pride of being half German.
Yeah.
You know, she just couldn't even think of that. It was just mind boggling to her that they would have chosen this.
Of course. And then finally, in June 18th, 1945, she reunites with Robbie.
Yeah.
And at this point, Captain W is totally in love with her and basically trying to talk her out of it. But she remains faithful to Robbie and basically says, you know, look, we had our whatever, but this is the man I'm going to marry.
Right.
And it's hard for W to accept because he seems to have fallen completely in love with her by this point.
Yes. And Inga, though, reiterated, because Mary wrote a letter to her father that summer saying, well, maybe I shouldn't get married to Robbie, you know, and she kept listing all these accolades of belonging to W and how he was so experienced and so accomplished and, you know, and oh my gosh, but Inga somehow got hold of that letter.
Yeah. And set her straight. So she was confiding this to her family.
To her father. But then I guess he told Inga and Inga said, oh, no way. We don't go against our promises in this family.
Yeah.
And she's promised that young man.
Yeah. And Robbie had been writing to the family.
Well, both of them did.
Yeah.
And there were other men that did too, but I just couldn't include all that stuff. Another one was Bob, and she finds out Bob is married. I mean, there's just,
wow.
You know, you think about how many men there were versus women.
Yeah, 48 nurses and thousands and thousands of men. Sure. So when they saw a pretty young American woman, they were like, hey, I want to be your friend. So then it takes her a while because, as you said, she thinks she's going to be deployed to the Pacific Theater.
That's right.
And then eventually it's not until October, end of October, that she returns to the States.
Yeah, they kept her in that station hospital to care for and it's mainly Germans left there.
Yeah. And the number of nurses keeps going down and down and down. And she's one of the last ones left. And then finally she gets to come back to the States. And then she comes back to St. Paul and she locks herself in her bedroom.
And I didn't know that. She never mentioned it to me. It was probably 6 years ago. I was on the phone with my Aunt Nancy and interviewing her.
Mm-hmm.
My Aunt Nancy died just a couple of months ago at age 100. Mary lived to 99 and a half.
Wow.
So, but when I was talking with my Aunt Nancy, her memory was impeccable. And she told me the story of Mary sequestering herself. And I had no idea.
Mm.
And they were just beside themselves. How are we going to get this wedding going that's coming up in February if Mary won't leave her room?
Yeah. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, because to process that experience, to just come back home and everything's over and you've been so emotionally tied to all of these people and they've all scattered to the winds, it must be so disorienting. And then you've seen all this death and destruction and then suddenly everything's normal again.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, who wouldn't just want to crawl in a hole?
How do you reconcile all this? And I'm sure it took her months. And then in the midst of this, W shows up again. He wants to see her. So she's still got that is sort of somewhat unresolved, right?
Yeah.
And then eventually she does leave. And when do Robbie and Mary get married?
The following February in 46.
In St. Paul.
And then W still doesn't give up.
Yeah.
Calls her after she's had her first baby.
Wow. And she ends up having 6 children, you said?
Yes.
Wow.
And it's funny because in a letter that she wrote while they were on the ship together, the HMS Andes on the way, when they first fell in love, she and Robbie, she said, "We've both decided we're going to have 6 little rebels."
Really?
Because my father was from Mississippi.
And she does.
Yeah. And some of us are more rebellious than others out of those.
But she has a full life after that, but she doesn't really talk about the war. And she never seemed to really heal from it.
Yeah, only in the family lore were the, were, you know, I mentioned that the they were just the light, the gaffes that she did. Like the time she got to dance with General Bradley on Riviera, asked her to dance. She would talk about that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, when I was growing up.
Right. So the highlights, but all the death and destruction and caring for all the pain and suffering and awful conditions that they lived in. The confusion, the anger.
I'm just thinking back on my son, Jacob. He was, I think, about 14 or so, maybe going on 15 when he was probably just almost 15. And he came into the kitchen and my mother was sitting there having a little something to eat. And he decided that he would start dropping the F-bomb every 2 seconds, you know, in front of his grandmother. And it was so funny the way she handled it. She just put her fork down and she turned and said, "Jacob, I don't know why you think you're going to get my attention using that word. You know, I was in a war. And let me tell you, the boys, that was their favorite word to say and their favorite thing to do."
Yeah.
And then, of course, my son, Jacob, thought that was the greatest thing he'd ever heard and said, "Oh, grandmother is so cool."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. Wow. She was cool. What a remarkable woman.
Yeah.
And did she keep in touch with Mona and Lorraine? And
she did Lorraine because she'd known Lorraine before the war.
Right.
So I got to meet Lorraine when I was 16.
Yeah.
We went to visit her in Tacoma, Washington. She'd married a Navy guy.
Mm-hmm.
But she cut everybody else off.
Really?
She just couldn't. She couldn't go there
yeah.
with anybody that was that she had loved so deeply in that war. She just.
Wow.
And I, you know, Peter Riva told me he felt like she had to do that to save herself psychologically.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, to this day, he said, "I think that Mary chose Robbie over W because even though Robbie was in that war, he didn't share that war with her."
Yeah.
And she couldn't have W in her face every day.
And the memory of every time she'd look at him, she'd remember.
Because they shared the same experience.
That makes absolute sense.
It does.
Yeah.
You know, some of my siblings would like to think that she was just overwhelmingly in love with Robbie. And I think she was. But at the same time, come on, you got to save yourself after you've been through something like that.
Yeah, yeah. You got to put it behind you somehow. Yeah.
Right.
And so she didn't stay in touch with even Mona.
Not even Mona.
Wow. Well, that says a lot right there.
Yeah.
Wow. Incredible. And you just wonder how many other people were like other Marys were there, both male and female, after that war.
Yeah.
And people back then didn't even talk about it. There was really no treatment. There was no understanding.
And I didn't know until I asked her about, she was assigned the shock ward, which was like, you know,
yeah,
they called it combat exhaustion. Now, they didn't use PTSD or any of those types of terms. But did you know to get into the shock ward, you also had to be physically in some way hurt, injured, or sick? The Army didn't just put you in the shock ward for mental treatment.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes they'd have to just come up with something to justify them being in that ward physically so that they could justify them being there. And just the denial, the pathological denial of what that does to people.
In some of the letters, she talks about like some nights where she's on the ward and it's just all these men like screaming out, having nightmares and calling for their friends or their mothers or so on in different languages.
That's right.
I mean, it just sounds like an absolute nightmare, hellish. And to have to do this night after night, and every night, like a new crop of wounded, beautiful young people, right? Because everybody was, you know, 19, 20, 20 years old, the prime of their life. And here they come in broken and
And, you know, it was really interesting to me when she told me about their hair all matted and long.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, in the movies, we always see them as cut, you know, all these crew cuts. And,
yeah, yeah.
And she goes, oh, I know. She said, that's always driven your daddy and me crazy when we watch a movie, because that's not war. That's like, you know, they didn't come that way all.
Yeah.
You know, they hadn't had anything. Their hair had grown out, their beard, their everything was just. You know, and they had lice everywhere. And the first thing we had to do was de-lice them all. And she's, you know, as soon as we could.
Yeah, they hadn't taken a shower in weeks.
No.
They hadn't cut their hair in months or, yeah. They didn't have barber shops and hot showers and so on and so forth. Yeah. The propaganda machine was powerful even in those days. Very powerful.
And she often talked about the propaganda machine on the German side, but
yeah,
she doesn't realize it's just as much on our side.
Absolutely. It was very powerful on our side.
But you're in war, so you do what you have to.
You do what you have to do. And you can't tell people back home what it's really like, because if they heard what it was really like, they would be much more ambiguous about the whole enterprise.
Yes, like what came out of that letter, that excerpt that you that you read earlier. I mean, it was quite a mixed bag of feelings there.
Yeah, and there were others like that. And Mona writes one, too, that's really powerful. Really powerful. Because that's, it's like, hey, this isn't good.
Yeah, she quotes Patton, I think.
Kind
of run through Normandy or whatever. It was.
Very strong.
Quite angry.
Yeah, lots of anger. And as you said, rage. That was her one word to describe it, like to do this to so many people on both sides.
And she thought for sure we'd never do that again.
Yeah.
She just said, no way.
Yeah. Yeah. We're doing it all the time. We got to go to war here. We got to do this. And who goes?
The young men.
19-year-old, 20-year-old.
And women now.
Yeah. And men and women. Yeah. And get their bodies blown apart.
Decided by all the people that we're going to do this.
For reasons that...
Military production.
Right. No. It's pretty cynical and ugly. But thank you so much for the wonderful book. Your mother must be extremely proud of you. And it really brings her to life and her struggle and what she endured to life. It's really wonderful. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it, Ralph. It was great to talk with you.
On May 6, 1944, Lieutenant Mary Ballster wrote, quote, "So often they ask for their parents, especially, of course, for their mothers. And I've held many a boy's hand and pretended I was his mother at the end. I always say something like, better you should sleep. Everything will be okay when you wake up. Rest. And most of the time, I've been lucky. And they close their eyes and die, thinking their mother is right there with them. In important ways, the young nurse who arrived at Fort Leonard Wood on March 31, 1943, didn't return to St. Paul, Minnesota after the war. As her daughter, NCR Davis, observed, part of her mother never came back from the war. Maybe that's the price she had to pay for seeing what she saw, and for healing and giving comfort to so many wounded and dying soldiers during the war. We thank Mary Ballster for her bravery and her service, and her daughter for telling her moving story in the book For the Boys. It's my great honor to name Mary Ballster and NCR Davis as today's Heroes Behind the Headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Pizzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.